I'm Kimberly Cronick. Today on Focus, we'll discuss women's health with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's a board-certified OBGYN. We'll talk about cancers associated with women and their prevention, including the news last week of Angelina Jolie's double mastectomy after discovering she carries a genetic mutation that increases her risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. These genetic mutations are relatively rare, and the vast majority of women who choose preventative mastectomy aren't facing that elevated risk. Dr. Troopin can talk about a wide range of women's health issues over a woman's lifespan, including sexual health and sexuality, premenstrual syndrome, perimenopause, menopause, osteoporosis, and more. Do you have questions about your health or the health of a woman in your life? If you do, we hope you'll join the conversation as we talk about women's health from menses to menopause today on Focus after this news. I'm Kimberly Cronick, and this is Focus. Today we're talking about women's health. My guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. Dr. Troopin can talk about a wide range of women's health issues over a woman's lifespan, including premenstrual syndrome, perimenopause, menopause, osteoporosis, sexual health and sexuality, and more. If you'd like to join the conversation and talk with her, if you have a question, you have an experience, or you have a comment, we welcome your calls as well as your emails. You can join at 333-9455 or toll 3-800-222-9455, or you can email us a question at whale-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning, Dr. Troopin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you on the show. Well, let's start the conversation with something that's on a lot of people's minds, I think. We know Angelina Jolie last week announced that she had a preventative double mastectomy and will probably have ovarian surgery as well. And she had the mastectomy because she has a genetic mutation that increases her risk of developing both breast and ovarian cancer. I wanted to ask you, doctor, how many women are like Angelina Jolie? What percentage of women have that genetic mutation that, as a result, will increase their risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer?
Well, there are a couple of issues. One is whether you have any kind of genetic risk. And the second question would be sort of part B. What you've asked is what specific genetic disorder does she have that is called breast cancer? We think that the approximately 1 in 8 risk of every American woman, so about a 12% risk of breast cancer is in our population in general. But if we take all of those women, we think that probably only 20% have direct genetic links that we know about that they're born with. We can acquire genetic breaks in our DNA that can predispose us to certain cancers. That's probably separate. So probably about 20% of all breast cancer carriers have some sort of genetic link. And it's most common in people with moms or sisters or daughters. So what we call first degree relatives, a mom, a sister, a daughter. It is more common if you have other family members. So if you have lots of aunts or grandparents that have had breast cancers or other linked cancers, you mentioned ovarian cancer and on the male side, we tie prostate cancer into this to some extent, depending on the syndrome. But the genetics pass fairly strongly through that direct maternal first degree relatives, Angelina Jolie being someone whose mother had breast cancer.
So who should get tested, in your opinion, for the BRCA genes? Who's a good candidate for this?
So if somebody sits down in my office and says, do I need BRCA testing? We take lots of giant steps backwards. So who are you? What's your age? When should you begin routine screening? We have recommendations for young women to do what we call clinical breast exams. In other words, have a provider actually performing breast exams at a particular schedule. We recommend breast cancer screening with mammography. And then we try to take a family history. On my website, gynogab.com, I have links to the CDC sites and the National Institute of Health sites that lead you to information as to how to take that family history, because not everybody has done that successfully or has even thought about it. But if we can, we like to get a 3-generation look. If we can, that's very difficult going backwards. Going forward, I think it's going to be easier. So let's try to talk about what your family history is. once we look at those kinds of things, we look at a lot of separate side issues. Have you had kids? Are you going to have kids? If you had kids, are you going to breastfeed? What's your weight? What's your diet? Is your diet very high fat? Do you have an absence of exercise in your life? Those kinds of things that can minimize breast cancer risk that are good for your overall health. Very far away from getting to that discussion about mastectomy in targeted populations. Then we look if you have specific risk factors in your family. You've got perhaps genetic predispositions. There's Ashkenazi Jews are one group that has higher risk of BRCA 1 in 2 mutations. But if you have some kind of family history and you have some kinds of genetic predispositions, maybe you even know in your family somebody has tested positive for it. On the flip side, you may know that the person who you are linked to that had breast cancer actually tested negative. And if that person tested negative, then again, you're not necessarily a candidate for screening. Then once you determine if you're a candidate for screening, you decide what kinds of screening are you going to have. Probably most experts would say the best step is to talk to a genetic counselor before even deciding to have that screening. The most important thing you need to ask yourself is, how is this blood test going to help my case? Is this going to change my behavior? Is this going to change the frequency of mammograms? Is this going to change the type of breast cancer screening? Some very high-risk patients would be better off having MRIs as their screening. Is this going to change anything about medication? Am I going to be able to use other medication, perhaps like tamoxifen, raloxifen, medicines that we do use in high-risk patients to decrease my risk? So before you get any kind of medical test, you want to discuss with your provider, how am I going to use this information? And if the answer is, I'm not using this information because I'm not changing what I do or something like that, you probably don't need that test. BRCA testing is extraordinarily expensive. I think I read in some of the articles they were quoting $3,000. Our lab's about $3,500 around our Champaign-Urbana area. And if you don't have insurance coverage for that screening test, even if you should become eligible, it's going to be very difficult. I have many patients that are eligible in terms of criteria but haven't yet gotten that test because of the finances involved. It can be a piece of the counseling question to figure out even if you have insurance that would cover it. So those are the kinds of things that patients have to discuss with their healthcare providers. And many primary care providers are prepared to discuss this. Others would prefer that you get referred to a genetics counselor to finish that discussion.
So, right, talking about what you would do if you had the test is an important part of before you get the test.
Every test.
Okay. Well, I want to invite any women who have had this test or have had breast cancer and it's linked genetically, you're welcome to call in and share your experience at 800-222-9455 or 333-9455. This is Focus. I'm talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. We did start the conversation with the news that Angelina Jolie had that double mastectomy. We're talking about the cost of getting that test, the risk to women if insurance covers it. Dr. Troopin, when I was researching this, I also heard that over the past decades, doctors have noticed a big increase in the number of women who are choosing preventative mastectomies. And you talked a little bit about what are the other options besides mastectomy if someone is diagnosed with having this gene disorder?
So, again, it depends on who the patient is, her age, what her other risk factors may be, whether she has breast cancer 1 or breast cancer gene 2. Breast cancer gene 2 presents at about the same age as other breast cancers that women are at risk for. So we generally think that if you have steps that try to diagnose breast cancers early, that is, it's not technically preventing the cancer, but it's preventing the sequelae of the cancer. So if you're going to get routine mammograms, you're going to drastically reduce your chance of having metastatic breast cancer or one that's more invasive because you're very likely going to be picked up at an almost pre-invasive stage or even at the atypia stage. if you are going to take medication to reduce your risk, you reduce your risk by about 50% of having an invasive breast cancer. And if you go all the way to mastectomy, you're still only going to reduce that rate down about 90-95%. You're not reducing it down to zero at any rate. Same with ovarian cancer. We know that taking out the ovaries probably will reduce, we've always said taking out the ovaries reduces your risk of ovarian cancer by about 98%, but it may actually be less because much advanced ovarian cancer has actually now been linked to the fallopian tubes. So people who had ovarian removal but didn't have fallopian tube removal probably have greater risk than what we were quoting, say, 5-10 years ago.
If you're a woman with cancer who has experiences to share, you're welcome to join the question, the conversation, or if you have any questions for Dr. Troopen, the number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. If you feel more comfortable emailing a question or a story, you can do that at will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, there's been a lot of talk about breast cancer because of last week's editorial. And I know that according to the National Cancer Institute, as you said, just about 12.4% of women born in the U.S. today will develop breast cancer sometime in her lifetime. Doesn't mean she'll die from it, just means she'll develop it, which means then that on the flip side, right, the chance of a woman being born today who will never develop breast cancer is about 88%. So I'm wondering if women's awareness in the U.S. of breast cancer and their actual risk of developing and breast cancer and their fear of it is proportional in U.S. society. Do you think that we're overreacting? Do you think, what do you think is going on here?
Well, I think breast health is very integral, important part of women's health care in general. But if we were to say what kills women is cardiovascular disease. And we've talked about that in some of these shows before. And the number one first sign of cardiovascular disease in women is sudden death. So we don't even get warning signs. We have drastic consequences. And about 50% of all women who have significant cardiovascular disease actually have normal cholesterol levels. So many women have just gotten a simple cholesterol test and told that one number is fine, and they think they aren't at risk. And so this has been a big agenda for me of 2013, trying to inform women of what factors lead to cardiovascular disease, because it all ties back. Even our blood levels of inflammation. Blood levels of inflammation give us risk of cardiovascular disease, but they increase our risk for many other disease. Prediabetes, diabetes, actually kidney disease. They actually increase our risk of mental depression as well as Alzheimer's, and they increase our risks of cancer. So actually, looking at heart health is overall wellness. And yes, if you were going to say, I should only worry about one thing, sure, let's worry about cardiovascular disease. But still, a preventable cancer is breast cancer to some extent, because we can use some of these therapies to prevent cancers. And if we can't prevent it, we can diagnose it at a stage that it's virtually 100% curable.
Good. I want to talk, come back to the heart disease, but we do have a question, and I don't want to leave this caller hanging. Iris from line one has a question about a drug. Go ahead, Iris.
Hi. I'd like to know how you feel now about Evista as a substitute for other kinds of medications to help with osteoporosis, whether you think Evista is at least somewhat effective, and whether there are any cons, anything against using Evista. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, so the caller is fairly savvy. She's calling about a medicine that's a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. So it was born out of the desire to build a better hormone. So we know that every hormone has what we call positive or agonist effects and negative or antagonist effects. And we've discovered, for instance, that the molecule estrogen is pretty much all agonist. It just acts like a positive estrogen receptor trigger on pretty much every tissue that it can be taken up by. then there are these molecules that have a significant number of antagonistic features. They aren't technically hormones. They're molecules where their active portion will bind to the molecular structure of certain cells. So this medicine Evista, which is raloxifene, was designed as an osteoporosis therapy and prevention for women. It actually acts positively in the way estrogen does, in the positive chemical sense, on bones to improve bone health. The data for osteoporosis protection was never as robust as the data for bisphosphonates in terms of osteoporosis protection, but Evista had another side feature. By being a SERM, it had anti-breast cancer features, somewhat like the when we were looking at this initially through the study called the STAR trial, of which one branch was at Carl Clinic, and I happened to be in that study jointly with them. But the STAR trial actually looked at whether this molecule, raloxifene, could be acting anti-breast cancer like the drug tamoxifen. So what they did is they took women with risk, and they figured it out a little bit differently than the way Angelina Jolie figured out her breast cancer risk. They figured it out through the GAIL scale. And GAIL scale, G-A-I-L, you can again get that link through the National Cancer Institute. But if you Google it, you'll have all kinds of links to the GAIL scale. And they took the risk on GAIL scale of 1.67, a kind of odd number, that so not quite a double risk, but about 1.5 times risk of the average person in the U.S., which was actually equivalent to a 65-year-old woman's risk. And if by putting in these points in GAIL scale, and they do weight whether you've had a first-degree relative in the GAIL scale, it's very highly powered towards those first-degree relatives. So they took those individuals and they pitted raloxifene against tamoxifen to look at its breast cancer protection. And we knew from a previous trial, the National Cancer Breast Prevention Trial, that tamoxifen could lower your breast cancer risk about 55%. So instead of, if you would calculated out your 12.8% risk, 12.4% risk, you lower it by about 50%, you get down to a little under 5%, somewhere around there, we're pretty low, and after 5 years of use. And they looked at raloxifene, and indeed, it was about the same. Raloxifene also had some particular benefits over tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is what we call an agonist on the uterus. It acts like estrogen on the uterus. So it can increase your risk of uterine lining thickness. It can increase your risk of endometrial polyps, pre-invasive as well as invasive disease of the uterus. We think about there was as much as a 1 in 5 risk of these polyps or something worse with tamoxifen use, whereas raloxifene had no action at all against the lining of the uterus, so it didn't increase that risk. So raloxifene, if we use it for breast cancer prevention in selected individuals, can help her bone health, doesn't cause uterine cancer, and it can decrease her risk of breast cancer. So lots of benefits. The negatives to raloxifene is it's not as good on bones as some other therapies. You have to take it every day. So taking something every day for 5 years it's difficult. You also have to not get side effects from it. And there are a number of side effects, but leg cramps seem to be one of the increased side effects that I found most commonly in my patients. So there's been some excitement generated by the idea of Evista. And since Evista has come on the market, there were other SERMs before it. Not tamoxifen technically is a SERM, so is the infertility therapy Clomid. But since that time, there's been quite an explosion of different kinds of SERMs that we can make use. And now we even have one that can treat vaginal dryness and menopause.
Great. We'll get to menopause, I'm sure, a little bit later in the show. You are listening to Dr. Suzanne Troopin, and this is Focus. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist, and we're talking about women's health over a woman's lifespan. If you have questions about drugs, if you have questions about menopause or sexuality or different kinds of cancer, give a call. We'd like to hear from you, take your question. If you have a story to share about your health, you can also do that. The number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or if you feel more comfortable, you can email us a question or story at will-talk@illinois.edu. I actually have a caller here, line one, Linda from Savoy. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask your expert if she thought that the use of DES played into the cancer risk at all.
Well, we don't think that DES, I've not off the top of my head ever seen an article that linked DES specifically with breast cancer risk. What DES is diethylstilbestrol. It was an excellent estrogen used for many things. One of the things was that it was used for heavy menstrual bleeding, for high dose, short term therapy. For acute menstrual bleeding when we had no other therapies, it was terrific. But there were some studies back in the 1950s, and those studies seemed to indicate that if you took DES early in pregnancy, that you would have a reduced rate of miscarriages. And that study it was in the 50s, and the medical studies generally done long time ago had many flaws compared to the kinds of medical research that is done today. And it turned out that it didn't work, for starters. But not only that, but if a mom took that, especially a female fetus, there were some risks in males as well, but a female fetus could be fundamentally changed in her development so that she was at risk for a condition called vaginal adenosis, and that vaginal adenosis could lead to vaginal adenocarcinoma, glandular cancer within the cervix or the vagina itself. And the average age of adenocarcinoma, the vagina, in DES-exposed people was 28. And the DES registry still exists in Chicago. We were a little bit of a hub around here for it because Eli Lilly was the maker of DES. So so it seems to be linked to this vaginal adenocarcinoma. It was only used for a very short time, long time ago, and the epidemic of breast cancer has increased since then. So we do not think that DES is linked to that.
I was actually thinking in terms, and maybe this is what you're saying, the effect on the female fetus. Is her risk raised at all? And is that what you mean, or is it just my risk you're referring to?
It was primarily in the risk of the developing fetus.
Okay. Because she did have the other symptoms and had to go through a lot of agony to produce the actual baby. But because I was given that in the early stages of pregnancy. Well, you answered my question. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Linda, for your call. And let's go to Gail on line two from Charleston. She has a question about tamoxifen. Go ahead, Gail.
Hi. Well, first I wanted to say it's cool that I have, is it a scale, the Gail scale, was it?
Yes.
I've never known that, so I'll have to check into that. But I have been wanting to ask somebody this question for about 15 years. My mom was in a tamoxifen study in the 90s, mid-90s, for 5 years. And she found out at the end of her 5 years that she actually had taken tamoxifen. So she was in one of those studies. Well, about, I would say, somewhere around 6 months after the trial was done, she was done taking tamoxifen, she ended up dying of lung cancer, of small oat cell lung cancer. And I called, I still can't remember now how I had a telephone number, but I was able to call the people who had been involved with the study to let them know this, because I thought there was always a possibility, because she died within like a 3-month period, and I was always wondering, is it possible that tamoxifen could have masked the lung cancer? Is it possible that tamoxifen might have been a trigger for the lung cancer, or are they in no way related? But I've always been fascinated by that, because she finished that, and relatively soon after that, she had lung cancer and died. Have you heard of any connection in that whatsoever?
So a quick answer would be, no, I don't think so. But a couple other things. First of all, you start out by saying that you would do your Gale scale, which is excellent. And I do want to also tell our listeners, there are many other scales that we do use, but Gale scale being the predominant one, but there's one, Klaus, and I'm pretty sure it's C-L-A-U-S. When I start putting these little apps on my phone and my computer, I stop looking at how to spell everything, okay, but I'm pretty sure that's the one. And it is more highly powered for other relatives rather than first-degree family relatives. So genetic counselors will use lots of these different tools, but Gale scale is widely available. So in terms of how research studies are done, there usually is a relative. So we capture adverse events as we perform the study, and there are rules and regulations about how far past the end of treatment that we usually study patients out. So it sounded like your mom might have fallen out of that time frame, but occasionally I will get other pieces of information about patients that have been in various research trials as well. And definitely you can contact the people that perform the study. Also, the FDA keeps a site that's publicly available called MedWatch. And MedWatch is a little bit differently, but you can report any adverse event that comes with a medication or a product. So that, like, if you have an IUD and you accidentally get pregnant, you can make sure that the MedWatch site knows about that pregnancy and so forth. It's usually something that the physicians, the hospitals, and the actual manufacturers' representatives, this is a little sort of behind-the-scenes job that drug reps do for us, that they make sure that these kinds of events, as we know about them, are reported on. So that would be another source for people to report questions about it. In terms of lung cancer, there's no mystery. It's generally caused by smoking. Can we ask it? Was your mom a smoker?
She had quit over 25
quit.
Years before
yeah.
she developed
okay.
one.
So
I know statistically speaking that is still
it's still a link. Yes, yes, yes. There have been a large number of studies looking at estrogen use and whether that predisposes or actually protects a woman against lung cancer. There have been some mixed data, but there's been a sort of a trend towards some favorability. So you would have to say, well, maybe if you got tamoxifen, would your own estrogen levels be lower? Would that be something? But you also have to look at the biology, and I don't know this. You're going to have to talk to other healthcare providers, but the biology of cancers are such that cancers start as one cell. And for instance, with breast cancer, we know that at the time of diagnosis, we have about 8 to 10 years of that breast cancer being in our body. And there's some sort of lag time with lung cancer as well. So most likely, if she was diagnosed that rapidly, she actually had her lung cancer while she was in the trial, but the trial wasn't powered to look at that.
Right. Well, it's all very fascinating because you do find out about you know, what side effects happen with what drugs and what leads to whatever. And you just do wonder how all of the dots are connected at some point. It was good at least that she was able to participate in that particular study too. Her mother didn't die of breast cancer, but my grandmother died on my father's side. So the breast cancer is still a possibility in the girls on our family.
Well, thanks, Gail, for your call. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with some more questions and calls. We have a question that's about osteoporosis. We'll come back with that and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, in just a few moments. You're listening to Focus on WILL. My guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. Dr. Troopin can talk about a wide range of women's health issues over a woman's lifespan. Indeed, we have been doing that today with help from your calls. If you do want to call in with a question or you want to share a story, the number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. If you're more comfortable over email, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm Kimberly Cronick in for Jim Meadows. Doctor, we have a question about osteoporosis and low-acid diets. This comes in through our email. The person says that she read or saw a recent, listened to the People's Pharmacy, and they made a case about acid in the diet rather than calcium intake being linked to osteoporosis. A particular mention was the fact that countries with the highest calcium intake through dairy products have the highest osteoporosis rates. She wants to know, are you familiar with any research in this area? And if so, what do you think about that?
There's a lot of nutritional research regarding osteoporosis. There are many flaws that we can have in our diet that will predispose us to osteoporosis. So not getting that dairy intake as a youth is a potential problem. We lay down about 80-95% of our bone by the time we're 20 years old. So although we're still accruing some bone in our 20s, we're mostly accruing our bones in our teen years. So a high calcium intake when you're older is not going to necessarily be as protective if you don't have a good bone mass to start with. Also, genetics. Genetics are a big part. And so some of the dietary research is masked a little bit by the genetic research because, for instance, those with women with Asian backgrounds have much higher risk of osteoporosis than, say, African Americans. And so you need to factor out those ethnicities as well as looking at the dietary research. Also, depending on your intake of carbonated beverages, the phosphorus might be binding up your calcium. So if you sip a Diet Pop with your yogurt for lunch, you're binding all your calcium. You're not going to get that as effectively. We also know that protein has to be handled in a certain way. And some of these trends towards very high protein diets are a little bit concerning to physicians because they really aren't balanced. And we know that this protein has to come out of our intestinal tract, get into our bloodstream, get out through the kidney. And at the same time, these very high protein diets can leach some of the calcium with it and predispose us to osteoporosis that way. But again, if your protein source is primarily dairy rather than other kinds of foods, that's where, again, the research starts to cross over. And with osteoporosis prevention, you got to exercise. You got to get a decent amount of calcium. You don't need overly amounts of calcium. You got to get a reasonable amount of calcium. There's nothing wrong with being born with good genes. You have good genetic background. You can make a lot of mistakes, and you still won't get this disease. You want to do things that don't reverse your good bone health. So steroid intake is a big problem. So people with inflammatory joint diseases that are put on long, high dose courses of steroids. So certain medications that can go against you can weaken your bones. But there are certain basics that we want to do. And really some of these fine points of diet are a little bit, they're going to come out in the wash if you have a basic diet. If you follow the myplate.gov, I think this is myfoodplate or myplate.gov guidelines in terms of a balanced diet with the amount of fruit, the amount of vegetables, with the amount of fiber, with small animal source or whatever source protein you're going to to get, you're going to have a good bone health diet as well.
And what about weight-bearing exercise, particularly as a woman ages? Does that help with reducing a woman's risk of bone loss?
Well, we think that all exercise is beneficial. If you can't do something that's significantly weight-bearing, we all bear weight because we have less osteoporosis than, say, an astronaut who's in a zero-gravity environment. So we all bear weight to some extent, and most of the exercises that we do will be very beneficial. And again, exercise programs, we take a couple steps back. That people say, what should I do for exercise? You got to do three things. You got to stretch, and we can argue about whether you stretch before, after, or in between, whatever. Okay, you got to stretch. You got to get your heart rate up. So it's not right exercise if you're not breaking a sweat and you're having a whole conversation while you walk. Got to get your heart rate up, and you got to do something for strength. And I try to convince people that different exercises work different muscle groups. So you do the same one little run around your block walk every single day. It's not going to work enough different muscle groups. You're going to have to mix it up a little bit. And again, that will cover everything. It's going to work on your heart. It's going to work for a few calories. It's going to work on your mental well-being, and it'll work for your bones.
Excellent. We are talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin about a wide range of women's health issues. We welcome your calls and questions at 333-9455, or you can email them will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a question. This one is about hot flashes. A woman writes that she's 59. About 7 years ago, she went through menopause, and by that we mean that's the date of the last period, correct? That's what menopause means? Let's just clarify that.
It actually doesn't mean that.
Okay. Quickly, tell me what that means.
It's one full year.
One full
after
year.
After your
gotcha.
FMP or final menstrual period. So it's one full year.
Okay, one full year.
After that.
Okay, so she's in menopause, has been for 7 years. She says she's had serious hot flashes for the past 10 years with very little abatement, even as time goes on. She uses a BIEST hormone cream daily. She rubs it into her forearm, and her practitioner wants her to keep the dose as low as tolerable. She still, though, does have some daily flashes, flushing, perspiring. Within safe bounds, is there anything else she can do? And she wonders, why won't these things go away, these hot flashes?
So we do try to remind everyone that this is an informational session and that we don't give out individual medical advice and that it's very important to work with your individual healthcare provider for direct medical advice. And I know we've repeated that a number of times over the past X number of years, but just for clarification. So when patients say hot flashes, physicians say vasomotor symptoms. And those vasomotor symptoms can be anything from a feeling of heat, a feeling of coolness, actual sweating, a actual racing of the heartbeat. The heart rate can go up anywhere from 15 to 30 beats per minute for a short period of time. There's increased electrical conductance over your skin. There's increased blood flow to the skin. So there are actually a wide range of physiological kinds of things that do occur. And that whole process seems to be triggered by a estrogen deficiency in our system. So as women transition through their routine menstrual cycles into what we call the perimenopause, or that time leading up to the official definition of menopause, through menopause and then into postmenopause, there is early on a relative estrogen deficiency, and then eventually the ovary quits making estrogen at all. We all have some estrogen hormone in our body even far after the actual menopause time, because the ovary makes some testosterone that can be converted into estrogens. The adrenal gland make male hormones that can be converted into estrogen. So it usually is a process. And we think that somewhere between 90 and 98% of all patients will have some sort of vasomotor symptoms as they transition from perimenopause to menopause. And we think that by your late 80s, only about 2% of the population will have hot flashes. But when we've done longitudinal studies, the vast majority are are focused around those years of menopause with the average age. We used to say 51.4. They've dragged it down to about 49.5 now. But so late 40s, early 50s, definitely the symptoms are most prevalent in the population. But again, 2% will have them out into the 80s. So somebody who comes in the front door says, I'm 60, I'm 70, I'm 78. When's it all stopping? Well, she may be one of those in small percentage that does have a persistence. We think that virtually all cases of vasomotor symptoms, or what a patient's calling hot flashes, can be treated by hormone therapy. And the effective doses of hormone therapy that have been studied are within a range, but they are within a range that has what we think of as acceptable rates of heart attacks, strokes, breast cancers, all of which are risks from these therapies, which is why an individual provider tries to keep that dose range low, because there is a dose response for most of those kinds of things. So the things that about estrogen that increase your risk of heart attacks, you're increasing your risk more if you're going to raise that dose. However, within reason, dosage manipulation is very important. So the numbers of therapies for hormone treatments are vast. There are injections, there are creams, there are gels, there are sprays, there are implants. We don't use them very much. There are vaginal rings that actually provide systemic therapy. There are of course, pills, patches. So there are a huge range of products, and the vast majority of the options out there are provided by pharmaceutical companies, where they've been studied in terms of their preservatives, their blood levels, their effectiveness, and so forth. However, some women have chosen to get therapies that are more uniquely designed for them, and that works in some cases. And BIAST is one of those hormone therapies. It's only an estrogen therapy, so a woman with a uterus is not usually offered only BIAST therapy, because we think that it's very important to have a progesterone antagonizing component for that lining of the uterus that would be at risk for estrogen induced cancer. But BIAST is usually a combination of estradiol and estriol. It may be a combination of, it stands for bi 2. It may be a combination of estrone and estradiol. Estradiol is the estrogen our ovaries make. Estriol is an the estrogen that the placenta makes. And estrone is an estrogen that is what menopausal women have. And estrone is a very low potency estrogen. So it was the base of a popular menopausal therapy once, but we don't use it very much. But if somebody was on something called Triest, she might have all three of those components. Most of the BIAST active component is going to be probably that estradiol. There are no branded pharmaceutical products that contain estriol. They used to in Europe, but they don't use those as well, because most of the studies showed increased DVT rates. So if somebody is coming in and saying that they don't have therapeutic effectiveness from estrogen with their vasomotor symptoms, we take a couple of steps back. So first of all, what else is affecting things? Are you overweight? Being overweight is like wearing a fur coat. Very difficult to manage heat modulation if you don't manage your diet, your activity, your body fat content. So you definitely want to look at that. Number two, you're taking a medicine. What's your blood level? Are you? If it's not we don't always need blood levels to manage menopause. But if you have a therapy that's supposed to be giving you a particular blood level, are you? Compounded therapies are fairly notorious for not necessarily having a good blood level. So that's probably one of the simpler places you can look. you can't look by yourself. You got to look with a physician. And you probably need to look at blood levels and not salivary levels, which are again, notoriously inaccurate. So those are usually a couple of things. What else could be causing these symptoms? There are very few medical disorders that can cause vasomotor problems like a menopausal hot flash, but there are some. Also, what other therapies can be tried? So that the medication Estratest, for instance, that has an estrogen in it, it also has a synthetic testosterone, is actually approved for women in whom vasomotor symptoms are not managed by estrogen therapy. So there are actually approved medications for the indication that the woman is actually asking about. So there are other kinds of options somebody might be able to manage. And then finally, maybe you should come off your therapy. There's some data that says that you're going to transition off your hot flashes. And if you take hormone therapy when you have them, maybe at some point you're still going to have to go through that transition. So maybe transitioning off the therapy is going to be a good solution for some people who can't remain on therapy anyway. So maybe the solution isn't necessarily to do more, but less.
We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin about women's health over a woman's lifespan. She's a certified obstetrician and gynecologist. This is Focus. If you have a question, you may call and ask it at 333-9455, or you can email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have just about 4 minutes left before we have to end the show, so if you do want to call in, you should do that now. Dr. Troopin, let me ask you, when you talk about hot flashes, what about herbs like black cohosh, primrose oil? I know some women who've had some relief from that. Do you have any experience with that and women getting relief, and any cautionary notes?
There are many herbal products that are potentially successful in the treatment of vasomotor symptoms, and most are not harmful. Most barely beat placebo. Unfortunately, when we do the hot flash research trials, we get about a 40 to 60% effect of placebo. So when we enroll patients in our trials, and we usually enroll patients that are only moderate to severe hot flashes, which the FDA defines as 7 or more per day or 50 or more per week. So there's an actual definition. But when we enroll patients in those trials, one of the reasons that it's so difficult to prove that herbals work is that they are slightly better than placebo, but only slightly. Mm. So in some statistical studies, you would have to do a fairly large study, power it such that it's going to show that benefit. There's nothing wrong with, in most cases, with guidance from your healthcare provider, trying those kinds of therapies. And there are definitely individuals, for instance, those with active breast cancer, that are not necessarily candidates for systemic therapeutic use of estrogen therapy for their menopausal symptoms. But I probably think the data is a little better on evening primrose oil than black cohosh. Again, with the herbals, sometimes it's difficult to find a product that has good consistency within it. And it's hard to advise patients because it's not something that physicians are really kept in the loop about in terms of the potency. None of these things seem to work as well as estrogen for low libido. I happen to favor testosterone for low libido rather than an estrogen. And we do have one research trial enrolling, if anybody's interested, for those with orgasmic dysfunction, either pre or post menopause, that's using testosterone. So we'll see if that trial bears out fruit.
Great. We only have a minute and a half here. Dr. Troopin, let me ask you this. A lot of what we're talking about is a woman interacting with her physician to get, to figure out what to do with these kinds of symptoms. So tell us, what are some advice you would have for building a good relationship with your doctor, and when you have to go to a specialist, so it's not your regular doctor? Can you give us in just a minute or so some tips, what you found works?
Well, in a community like ours, we have a lot of patients that are very transient. They may be in town for a short period of time, and you want to get the most bang for your buck at your appointment. So know your own history. Keep records. If you have a pathology report that was abnormal, keep a copy of it. and see if your next doctor, what his or her opinion might be about that. Take notes. If you're not a good listener, you can take a visitor with you to take the notes for you. And make sure you actually schedule the right kind of appointment. So don't schedule a quickie little check if you actually have your list of 10, 15 things to cover, because you're not going to get all those things covered in a short period of time. So a lot of taking charge of your own care, doing some reading ahead of time and knowing what your top couple, three questions are on your particular issue.
Great. Well, I want to thanks to Dr. Suzanne Troopen, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, for talking with us today about women's health.
Thank you.
Please leave us your thoughts and comments about today's Focus program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, or you can also email them to us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Focus is repeated each weekday night at 8 on WILL AM 580. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. On Tuesday's Focus, we'll talk about bone marrow transplants. Jim Meadows will speak with Brendan Harley. Brendan was first diagnosed with cancer when he was in high school. At the age of 17, he underwent a bone marrow transplant to save his life. He'll talk about how the experience propelled him to pursue a career in cancer research, and we'll talk about bone marrow transplants in general. That's Tuesday on Focus. Again, we always welcome your questions and comments. Again, you can email them to us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can also go to our website and check out all the programs. All the archives of these shows are on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus.